years ago, there was an ad on the TV, and I think I saw it in newspapers, used in other ways, but it went like this. On the TV, it said, accidents only happen to others. But just in case you're one of those others, please fasten your seatbelts. Years and years ago, I remember seeing that on television. Any of you ever see that commercial on television? A few of you? Okay. Some of the middle-aged or older hands went up. Everybody always sort of believes that accidents happen to others. And yet, somebody has to make up those others because accidents, therefore, don't just happen to others. They can happen to us. Years ago in Cincinnati, when I was an elder in that area in about 1975, I met a man by the name of Ralph, who was a very fine man. He was crippled. He'd been baptized in 1957. I still remember that like it was yesterday. And he was called by God at the age of 37 in 1957. And he'd had a pretty tough existence, literally from the moment he was born. When he didn't come, the doctors did what they used to do. They did it to my father and scarred my father in the side of his face the time he was born. They reached in with forceps and pulled him out, except in Ralph's case, they broke his neck. And that often happened to babies. Their neck was broken. Sometimes it killed them. Sometimes it paralyzed them. But it got them out, and that seemed to be better than any alternative. And obviously, in his case, it did not paralyze or kill him, but it did cripple him because his neck was literally broken. And babies' bones are pretty much mush anyway. Bones don't really harden until a person reaches 16. That's why any parent who's smart won't let their kids play football. Not a good idea to play football for various reasons anyway. Until somebody is 16. The ends of the bones don't fully ossify or harden until 16. So it broke his neck. And it created problems because of the way it partially paralyzed him that grew worse and worse over a lifetime. It created a 30-degree pelvic tilt so that when Ralph walked, his pelvis was tilted that much. Now just try to picture yourself walking like that. And he had to use eventually two canes because it developed into degenerative or traumatic arthritis. Traumatic arthritis is arthritis that begins with a trauma or an injury. A lot of football players and athletes, hockey players, later in their lives after they retire, become so crippled you wouldn't even want to see them. Their lives go downhill because they were hit so many times that though they never got osteoarthritis or degenerative rheumatoid arthritis, they got traumatic arthritis. Well, he got a lot of it. And my father broke his neck and developed a tremendous amount of arthritis in his neck because he fell and hit his head, broke his neck, didn't know it for 10 years till a doctor finally diagnosed it when the arthritis got so bad. Well, as a result of this worsening condition, Ralph eventually had to sit down. He just basically sat. And my wife and I would go visit him. And we would let him tell us stories about what it was like to be the very first person baptized in southwestern Ohio. And eventually, after a while, he sat for so long, he got what virtually, I guess, could be called bed sores. He would sort of get up, but it was so painful to walk, and he would come on over. But this rash developed from the top of his back all the way down to the back of his knees. And it was the most awful looking thing you ever saw in your life. And in the summer it was worse, of course, when it was hot than the winter. He would perspire and he would sit on this chair and it would just hurt something awful. And of course, with a broken neck, you can imagine other kinds of problems. He used to have terrible headaches. And so from virtually the time God called him all the way through the time we knew him, which was about 2 years before he died in 1977, shortly after we left the area, at that point, he was now 57, he got worse. And we grew to really love him. We'd go over and listen to him tell stories. We'd watch his spiritual condition. He was like a spiritual mailman to us by telling us stories. We were his spiritual mailman by bringing him news of what was going on in the congregation that he was no longer strong enough or able to attend. And he loved to hear what we could bring him as news, and we loved to hear the stories from the past that is basically sort of where his life was in terms of what he'd been able to experience with the brethren, but now no longer could in the same way. He had a remarkable wife. I thought that she was an amazing person. She literally, my wife and I used to talk, she just chirped like a bird. She was happy. She was positive. She would come open the door for us and was always there, with the exception of one time that I'll tell you about. She was always there, and she would sit and just sit, the happiest person you ever saw, except for this one time she wasn't there, when he had also, with these afflictions, developed a certain humility that was remarkable. And my wife and I showed up, and no wife there to open the door, and he wasn't expecting us. We didn't always tell him we were coming. We liked to surprise him. So he got up, and he came over with his two canes, but he had this horrible rash, and so he would leave his pants open. And I said, "Hello, it's me." And he didn't realize my wife was there, and sort of his pants were open and half down because the pain was so awful. And he opened the door, and he let us in, and he couldn't get out of the way, and there was my wife, and I didn't realize he would be dressed that way. I don't know if my wife even remembers this, but I will say that then he sort of, you know, moved a little bit, and my wife looked away, but it didn't bother him because in a way he understood his condition, and he understood that we understood it. But back to his wife. She was this remarkable, upbeat, always at services, had a good word for everybody. And then Ralph died in the faith. Every indication is that he died in the faith, very suddenly. And immediately she quit the church, never came again. She might have gone a month or so, and that was the end. And that struck me. I'd been transferred by that time, and it struck me that maybe that was a lesson. There was a lesson in terms of what that meant. He had done all the suffering. Turn to Galatians 5. When I was a student at Ambassador College, I, along with the rest of the freshmen, had to learn the fruits of the Spirit in order. There are 9 of them. I used to say them real fast. Love, joy, peace, patience, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Goes back to when I was, you know, a freshman. I can still clip them off. Except that's not what they say. They don't say love, joy, peace, patience, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Those are not the fruits of the Spirit. 8 of them are. 1 of them is not. Patience is not listed there. The fruits of the Spirit are love, joy, peace, long suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, and temperance, or self-control, as some translations have it. I've never met anybody who could not pretty much appreciate how, if these represent the mind of God, which is the character that His Spirit is, which is His mind, His character, everybody understands how love and joy and peace would reflect God. Christ is the King of Peace. God says God is love twice in 1 John. God is the happiest, most joyful being in the universe. He is very gentle. He is good. Goodness comes from godness. If there's anybody who has more godness about him than God, I wouldn't know who it was. Certainly faith. God has absolute confidence in his ability to carry out his plan. He has more faith than anybody in the universe. He's perfectly humble. He knows exactly what he is. He doesn't elevate or diminish himself in any kind of an artificial way. He is perfectly meek. He knows exactly that he is God. He's not deceived about his role at all, and that's what meekness is. Human beings are sometimes elevated above where they are, therefore not meek, and it comes from being deceived about themselves. God is meek. He can say he's the greatest being in the entire universe, the only God that there is, and be perfectly humble when he says it. And of course, God has perfect self-control. The problem comes, how can it be that suffering long, that's what long suffering is, being able and willing to suffer long, could be a quality of God? And so for years, I literally read that, and there's a different Greek word that describes the word patience, but I never looked it up. And I just said, love, joy, peace, patience, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. But that's not what it says. Now, patience is a godly quality. Make no mistake. It absolutely is. But that is just not the fourth fruit of the Spirit. Mercy is a godly quality. It's not listed there. Wisdom is a gift of God. It's not listed there, as is knowledge and understanding. There are other qualities of God. But the fruit of the Spirit there says long suffering. And you know what? When you look it up in the Greek, you say, well, maybe there's a key to the meaning of the word. When you look it up in Greek, let's see what it means. You look it up, and you know what it says? The word means long suffering. That's exactly what it means. Now, what is the purpose of suffering? Why would God, how would God ever suffer? You might think about that statement. Why would God want human beings to suffer? The other eight make really good sense. But why would God want people, let's put it a different way, to ever have to hurt? Now let's really get inside this question. Let's really get inside the question. Why would pain be part of God's plan? Why? Think of all the different kinds of pain that there are. You may have experienced some of them today. Let's just talk about physical pain. You ever had a foot go to sleep and you feel needles? That's the type of pain. If it's really extreme, you've really pinched a nerve or really cut off the blood vessels that go to the foot because of the way you crossed your leg or whatever, the needles can be quite extreme. Needles are no fun. It's a type of pain. You know what? God designed your nervous system so that you would feel tremendous pain in that way, in some cases. There are something like 7 million nerve endings per square inch on your body. God didn't have to design it that way. There are. There's searing pain. You burn yourself. My wife burned herself the other day. Everybody here has burned themselves. And there's few pains like it. There's pain of itch. Now, typically an itch is not a pain, but there is a painful kind of itch, a certain brand of itching that is painful, that hurts, that many of you have probably experienced. Poison ivy, athlete's foot, certain other types of pain mixed with the itching. A heart attack. I've never had a heart attack. I've had people describe heart attacks. I've seen people, I've been in their presence when they thought they might be having a heart attack. My father-in-law was having a massive heart attack while I was literally rubbing his chest, and we were waiting for the paramedics to come. He was lying in bed, what turned out to be the last night of his life, and he asked me to come up and anoint him, and I was massaging his chest. And then it would go away, and we'd be better, and we almost didn't call the paramedics, but we thought, maybe we better call them. And they came, and the heart attack became massive, and he died about 5 hours later. I will tell you, watching that pain, not having experienced it, it's not a pain I ever want to see, but it's a unique pain. It's like somebody takes their knuckle and slowly grinds it right into your solar plexus, right into the sternum. Nothing quite like it. You've all experienced throbbing pain. You know, generally from inflammation and infection. Tissue is swollen because it has gone through what's called effusion. That means body fluids come into the area to try to cool it because it's hot, it's infected, it's red, it's angry, it's swollen. And it will often throb. Why does it throb? For a couple of reasons. The nerve endings that are in that area are often being pinched. They can't fire right in that area because of the infection or the cut, and so forth. So they will fire at an interval. That's one reason. And they will fire back to the brain in a way that appears to sort of throb, like a rhythmic pain. It's not fun. There's tingling. Tingling's another kind of pain. Now stop and realize, God created all these pains. He created piercing pain. Just, oh, wow, you get a sharp pain. I've seen people get them. I watched somebody carrying luggage one time. and he got a sharp pain in his back, and he was walking ahead of me, my brother-in-law actually, walking ahead of me, carrying some bags, and he dropped the bags and collapsed against the wall and just cried out loud, and I didn't realize he had that bad a back problem. I've had those kinds of sharp pains, I'm sure you have. They just pierce you. It's like somebody rammed a spear in a spot. You can't quite explain it. Headaches and various other kinds of pain. Ache would be another kind of pain. An ache can be anywhere from mild to devastating. You can't get away from it. It can be a headache. It can be a migraine headache, which often involves sharper types of pain that goes beyond the headache. Now, arthritics suffer pain. As a matter of fact, the system in the body, the joints of the body, can only handle so much pain. Doctors have learned that if people have degenerative rheumatoid arthritis, which is systemic, in other words, it's rheumatic, it's part of the system, it's not from an injury, it's a different kind of arthritis. It will attack for so long that eventually people go through what's called burnout. They literally reach a point where they slowly freeze up from bony overgrowth, and the nerves in the joints just simply burn up, and they no longer fire, and there's no more pain. It goes from worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse till many arthritics who are afflicted all through their body suffer burnout. The pain absolutely stops. Their nerves are destroyed. They hurt so long, were attacked by so many chemicals and minerals that were deposited in there as a result of the inflammation, that it destroys the nerves. The good news is they don't hurt anymore. The bad news is sometimes they're literally locked in a sitting position. They can't move. They have to sleep that way. They're just frozen in whatever position that their joints may have been. They have to be carried to the restroom and so forth. But you know, there's other kinds of pain besides physical pain. There's mental pain. I've experienced mental pain. You've experienced it. Different things trigger it in different people. And God designed people so they don't just have physical pain, but they actually suffer mental pain. And mental pain can hurt terribly. It can hurt terribly. I'll prove to you in a moment that some forms of mental or even psychological pain, because there's psychological pain, I'll prove to you in a moment that psychological pain can be greater than physical pain. I'll prove it to you in a moment. But I won't do it yet. So there's mental and there's psychological pain. There's emotional pain. Emotional pain can be so devastating it cripples people. It sends them into clinical depression. People can be ready to get married. This can happen to men or women. And I've seen it. I've counseled people who have gone through this. They can be ready to get married. And as a result of coming sort of almost to the altar and the bride or groom-to-be jilts them, they pull out. They leave them. The party who was ready to go forward is so devastated, so traumatized emotionally, they say, I will never marry again. They shut their nerves down because the pain is so intense. They say, I can't ever experience this pain again. That's it. I'll die single. And they do. Now some people actually get married and get jilted. A mate dumps them. Maybe they did or didn't see it coming, but it happens, dumps them. And these same people say, I will never marry again. I don't believe it's better the second time around. And they make that decision, and it's terrible. People suffer the death of a child. They say, that's it, I will never have another child. It was just too painful. Now I'm going to prove to you that psychological pain is worse than physical pain. If you were offered the hypothetical choice, those of you who are parents, we're offered the hypothetical choice where I said, we burn off, not chop off, we burn off, or chop off or any other way, just burn off a horrible way of losing an arm. You have a choice of losing an arm or losing a child. Would any of you even hesitate? You would say, absolutely. Which arm? You just hold them both out and say, take one. Any parent who wouldn't would be aberrant. Who would say, well, go ahead, take my child. I think 99.99% of people, well, they wouldn't want to lose their arm, but they'd say, take an arm. They'd take the physical pain, no matter how great, as opposed to the psychological pain of losing a child. If that proves nothing else, it proves to you that there is such a thing as psychological pain. The whole country suffered tremendous psychological pain at the death of JFK Jr., if you think about it. it just literally wallowed in this horrible, terrible experience. I mean, we know he'll come up again. And in some ways, he might have been taken away from worse things that would have come. But the country doesn't understand that. The country's so confused that I literally listened to the same newscast say things like, it's good his mother didn't know he died. She loved him so much she couldn't have stood it. And a few minutes later they say, he's in heaven with his mother. Now that would suggest that his mother knew he died because she's in heaven with him. You see what I'm saying? People out there in the world don't understand God's plan. And certainly nobody understands why God allows pain. And all the theologians stand up and they start ruminating about why God might allow the whole country to go through this terrible trauma. And I hurt for them. I'm not going to criticize them. They don't know. They're blind. They don't understand the plan of God. And years ago, we had an article that we produced, Why Does God Allow Suffering? Why does he do it? Look at Ecclesiastes chapter 7, if you would, please. We're going to look at a number of verses today. Ecclesiastes 7. It is better, verse 2. Now, would you agree with this? It is better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting. Okay? We're going to have a ball tonight. But you know what? It's better to go to the house of mourning than the house of feasting. For that is the end of all men. Everybody believes life is about who can have the biggest and best and longest party. Who can best avoid mourning and suffering? And the living will lay it to his heart. Well, if you're sitting here, you're alive, and you're supposed to stop and realize that most people want a life filled with feasting. Oh, feasting isn't bad. We're already getting feast fever. I can't wait to go to the feast. Bible says, he that's of a merry heart has a continual feast. Nothing wrong with feasting. But it is better to go to the house of mourning. Now, do you agree with verse 3? Sorrow is better than laughter. A lot of God's people are going through a lot of sorrow right now. Do you believe that laughter is better? Sorrow is better than laughter. For by the sadness of the countenance, look at this, the heart, that's the mind, is made better. Now, how is that? Well, we haven't answered how exactly, but we certainly have a couple of statements about why God allows pain. Because the book of Revelation says there's coming a time when there will be no more sorrow, no more pain, no more death. But that's not yet. The reason is sorrow is better than laughter. I haven't explained why. It's just that God created pain so that people would suffer sorrow because it's better than laughter. Once again, we haven't explained why, other than by sadness of the countenance, the heart is made better. How? How does that work? I mean, how does that work? We'll see. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. Wise people introspect. They try to learn. But the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It's party time. You ever been invited by one of your friends? Says, hey, can you come on over in 2 weeks on Saturday night? We're going to be doing some mourning. Could you please show up? I've never been invited to 3 hours of mourning. I've been invited to parties before. I've had invitations to say, could you please come to our party? Nobody says, could you please come to our mourning? It is better to hear the rebuke of the wise. Oh, a lot of people don't believe this. A lot of people do not believe that it is better to hear the faithful rebuke of a friend than to receive the deceitful kisses of an enemy, as one of the Proverbs say. God says it is better. There in that proverb and here, it's better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. A song is pleasant, a rebuke is not. It's just that the song isn't as good for you as the rebuke is. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is vanity. Now, brethren, stop and ask yourself, do you agree with that? That being all five of those verses? Sorrow is better than laughter, better to go to the house of mourning than feasting, and so forth. Rebuke's better than a song. Mourning is better than mirth. I'll tell you what, human nature does not agree with that verse at all. No way you'll find a human being who will agree with that verse. And you look out in the world, and that's why you've never been invited to a morning party, which is kind of an oxymoron, if that's the right word. You can't have both. It just doesn't work that way. Chapter 8 and verse 14. Is this fair? Let me ask you if verse 14 is fair. Some of my teachers and my father taught me, son, forget it, life isn't fair. Don't look for it to be fair. Some people want things to be fair. Life isn't. Here's proof. There is a vanity, a uselessness, a futility is what it means in the Hebrew. Something done in vain, literally done in vain is what it means. There is a vanity, a uselessness that's done upon the earth, that there be just men, good people, unto whom it happens according to the work of the wicked. Good people have bad things happen to them. Again, there be wicked men to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. And I said, this also is futile. It's useless. It's empty. It's vain. Well, Solomon drew a wrong conclusion humanly from that. He said, look, it'll drive you mad to think about this. Just go enjoy yourself. And I commended mirth. I want to laugh because it's just too mind-boggling to think about how good people could have bad things happen and bad people could just seem to have things going so well. Read Psalm 73 and you'll find that it frustrated David that he was going through all this suffering and he would see people around him and the good times were rolling for those people. It got David flat out into a bad attitude that was only resolved when he went in and he prayed about it. And he realized that their destruction was going to come very suddenly, unexpectedly. And the good times that were rolling were going to crash and burn in those people's lives. And he handled it. He understood it as a result. Chapter 9 and verse 10. Whatsoever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there's no work, there's no device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave where you go. Because we're all going there. Two things common to all lives, death and taxes, you've heard it, pointed unto all men once to die. You and I are headed for the grave, unless, of course, we're part of that one generation, which I expect, without a doubt, will involve some who are alive and remain, who will not have to suffer literal death, although their physical body will drop away and die at that time of change. So that appointment that everybody has to keep to death will actually happen to the physical body. I returned. A lot of people read verse 10, but they don't read verse 11. I returned, and I saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. Neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill. Now let's stop and look at that, because it goes on and says, but time and chance happens to them all. Wouldn't you normally say if there's six guys, the six fastest guys in the world, and they're going to run the 100-meter dash to establish the world's fastest human at any given Olympics, you would typically say, wait a minute, the race is going to be to the swiftest. That's what you would say. If you got six guys who are fast and one's a little faster, he's going to win. But the race isn't always to the swiftest, because what if the swiftest isn't feeling quite up to the race? What if the swiftest fall starts twice and is disqualified? What if the swiftest slips coming out of the blocks when a 100-meter dash is decided by bing, bing? I've done a lot of racing as a sprinter, only I did it in the water. And I will tell you, I saw many, many photo finishes and was involved in a lot of them, where two guys are coming to the wall, you've got judges, and it's just literally like that. And sometimes almost a dead heat. And you have three watches on each guy, and you have to average it. And you might find out that one guy in a 50-yard dash beat another guy by a hundredth of a second. Can you tell how little that is? But electronic clocks can. And they finally reached the point where they realized guys were so fast in the events, even later after I swam the 50-yard dash and 100-yard sprint, actually, they were so fast and so close and so many of them that it took electric devices to tell who won. But you know, as a swimmer, some guys would miss their turn. They wouldn't anticipate the start properly, and or they could get disqualified, or other things could happen. I lost the state championship in the ninth grade. I absolutely won the race. It was the greatest moment in my life at that point, except I reached for the wall at Ohio State University. I was in the ninth grade, but it was the state high school, state age group championship, YMCA. I reached for the wall and missed it because of the shadow in that unique pool down there in the natatorium. The pool's still there. And I missed, and I reached and reached and missed, and I was awarded second. And it was devastating to me, but I was way out ahead. The race was actually filmed. I learned a lesson. I was favored to win, and I lost, and the race wasn't to the swift, only I didn't know God's truth at that point. Or battle to the strong. Well, you'd say the biggest army's going to win. But what if the biggest army gets ambushed? What if the biggest army gets caught in a Russian winter without sufficient clothes? Because Hitler said, the battle's going to be so short, we're going to destroy Russia so fast, I don't want to issue winter clothing to the troops because I don't want them to think it's a long campaign. We're big enough, we'll crush them. And they were defeated literally in the suburbs of Moscow. And the battle was not to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise. You'd say the guy who's going to make the most bread, the guy who's going to get to eat the most bread, you know the terms, is going to be the one who's the wisest businessman. Except like yesterday in Akron, you can have a $4 million business, and a machine sparks and burns your building down, and he's wiped out. He's out of business. Doesn't think he has enough insurance to recover. Nor yet riches to men of understanding. Sometimes riches go to men of understanding, but what if they make the wrong decision in the stock market and they're wiped out? See, things can go wrong, nor yet favor to men of skill. But what if the man of favor is in the wrong place at the wrong time, and his skill does not save him, and he's cut because there's somebody else who has equal skill but who's younger and the company wants to invest more into, you see? Those are important verses to consider. Why did those things happen? Because there is a law called time and chance that happens to them all. You can be flying out across Long Island Sound, and everything just comes together wrong. There's too much haze. You're over water. You can't see the lights. You don't have your instrument rating. You didn't commit some terrible sin. It's dark. You're not quite skilled enough. You're in a new high-performance aircraft, and it just goes wrong, and you lose your life, as those three people did, and they'll come up in the resurrection. And we may have to tell them what happened to them more than ask them what happened. We'll tell them they were found after 4 or 5 days of searching. We'll tell them that they were buried at sea. They won't know any of that because time and chance happened to them. They were not particularly evil sinners. Everybody breaks dishes. Everybody does it. Everybody breaks things. Everybody hits their thumb with a hammer. I was putting up a picture in my office yesterday, and I hit my thumb with a hammer. Most people choose times like that to worship God. That's the only time they ever worship God, is when they hit their thumb with a hammer. It really hurts. And it hurts. I mean, there's just nothing like it. I'll tell you a story. My son had a friend the other day who hit his thumb with a hammer, hurt profoundly. The blood built up so badly under this nail that this guy called my son and said, do you have a drill? He said, yes, I do. He said, I'm coming over. He jumped in his car, drove over to my son's house, plugged in the drill. It's an incredible thing. And literally took the drill and drilled right through his nail. It hurt so bad, he couldn't stand it. He could hardly drive the car. Drilled right through, blood spurted all over my son's kitchen table. He said, oh, it feels so much better. I don't even heard of that kind of pain. Everybody has flat tires. Everybody gets thrown by a horse. Everybody slices their finger when they're cutting the orange open. Everybody bumps their shin. It hurts like crazy because of this thing that called a periosteum around your shin bone. Do you know you have a periosteum around your shin bone? That's the stuff that makes bumping the head and bumping the shin hurt. It's around all the bones. It's what feeds the bones. The nerves and the blood vessels are all on the outside of the bone. It's just everywhere else it's covered with meat. But when you get hit there, it hurts. Ever hit your crazy bone? Think you're going to die and afraid you're going to live if you hit it hard enough. I have. I mean, I wonder. I'm going to ask God in the resurrection. Why did you design the elbow that way? God must have fun designing the crazy bone. Everybody falls on the ice. Every child has a goldfish die. Everybody steps off a curb and twists their ankle. Everybody loses pets. It just happens. It just happens. Now, it doesn't always happen. Jesse Owens set 3 world records and tied another one in 45 minutes in what was considered the greatest 45 minutes of sports of all time. It happened 2 years after the 1936 Olympics when he got 4 gold medals. He's known for the 4 gold medals, but the greatest 45 minutes in sports history, most of you probably never heard of, it's when he tied 1 world record and set 3 others in 45 minutes. The race went to the swift. There was no time and chance there. But we all answer to the law of time and chance. That's why Mr. Armstrong used to say, experience is not the best teacher, but oh boy, is it a good teacher. Look at 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2. Do you believe this verse, brethren? A lot of God's people are suffering right now. They're hurting. They don't understand why they have to go through what they're going through. I've long said, and I believe fervently, nothing is out of control. Prophecy is playing out right on schedule. And people are playing out their role in it in many cases because they just don't believe the basic scriptures of the Bible. And a lot of people are suffering as a result. 1 Peter 2, verse 19, for this is thankworthy if a man for conscience toward God endure grief, suffering wrongfully. Let me tell you, have you been wronged? Do you feel you were dealt an unfair hand? Do you know what? If you take that and you smile cheerfully, you'll have an incredible reward because God will look down and say, you know what? What happened there was not right. It was not fair. It was unjust. But look at my servant handle it like a champ. They're not pouting. They're not feeling sorry for themselves. They're going on. Verse 20, for what glory is it if when you be buffeted for your faults, you take it patiently? Hey, you brought it on yourself. But if when you do well and suffer for it, you take it patiently, this is acceptable with God. That has meaning because you didn't deserve it. For even, why is this acceptable? Now, do you believe this? For even hereunto were you called. What? Because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps. Do you know what that's saying, brethren? It is literally saying you and I were called to suffer. It's part of your calling. Now, the world hadn't figured it out because it thinks the house of feasting is better than the house of mourning, and it always will until they're taught otherwise. That just doesn't happen to be what the Bible says. You were called to suffer, and Christ set us that example just as much as any of the rest of the example that he set for us. And nothing about differentiating between the suffering you deserve versus the suffering you don't. As a matter of fact, the suffering you deserve, God says, hey, that's no big deal. It doesn't mean anything. There's no glory in that, no reward in that. And you still have to suffer, but God says, that doesn't even mean much to me. But if you can handle a reversal, something that's wrong, and do it well, with aplomb, with a little bit of spiritual nobility, and just take it, that's remembered. That is acceptable. That means God accepts that as an offering. That's a different subject as to how that is actually an offering, but it is. A lot of suffering is we did nothing to cause it. Christ never did a single thing wrong in his life, and he suffered the worst, most horrible, humiliating death, as Paul wrote, even the death of the stake. You know, Christ didn't die by lethal injection, firing squad, the electric chair, or poison gas, which is quick and quote-unquote painless. Maybe there's a little pain, but by comparison to the death of the stake, none whatsoever. I told this story before years ago. I remember my father, you know, my father was sold paint for years, and his motto was, I sell it, you apply it. And I had to do the painting. I remember one time I ran in the house, and my parents caught me. You know, kids, they don't hit the light switch. And we had these yellow walls, pastel yellow walls, and dirty hands hit the light switch, and slowly the dirt built up around the light switch. In this lovely foyer area of the house, My dad said, I'm tired of watching you do that. I'm going to teach you a lesson. You go paint the whole foyer. Let's go get the ladder. And we painted the whole thing. And we had this long cathedral stairway. And I mean, it took me like 2 days. And when I was done, he said, needs a second coat. And I painted it again. And you know what? I never, for the rest of my life, missed a light switch. I went in slowly, and boy, I caught nothing but the switch. And sometimes when I did other things wrong, my dad had another switch he used. And that's just another part of childhood suffering. But I remember this one day, he wanted me to paint. And it was a hot, sticky day with a southern exposure, and I was painting this peaked part of the roof. And I had this long, shaky ladder, and my dad was taking a nap upstairs. It was a Saturday, and I was probably about 15 or 16 years old. You know how you put a bucket of paint on this on a hanger, and you hook it over the part of the ladder, the footrest, and you'd raise it. And as I kept painting toward the peak, and the ladder's getting closer and closer to the house, and you couldn't dip the paint in because you had to dip through the ladder rungs, and you would sort of to position and get the handle out of the way. I would twist. I didn't realize I was stressing the hanger. I kept twisting the same way, and all metal has a point where it gives. And I was way at the top of the second story of a real high peak over my parents' screened-in porch, where they had just put all this new furniture. And all of a sudden, snap. And I looked, I dipped, twisted, snapped, and I watched the paint drop 2.5 stories, kind of gyrating. It didn't drop straight or dump. So what happened is when it hit on an edge, and it spun. And it was almost full, and it threw paint just in an incredible swath right along the entire wall of the screen. And when it hit the screen, thousands of little white droplets flew through the screen on every piece of furniture, this beautiful rug, on the cement, on everything. Life could not have gotten worse for me at that moment. I just thought, you know, I'm just never coming down from this ladder. I'm just going to stay here. I'm going to die up here. And then I thought, oh, no, my dad's taking a nap. My mother's gone. I mean, the grass was turning white. One bush was largely white. And I went up, and I went into my dad. I knocked on the door, and I knew I was about to suffer. And I knocked on the door. And my dad came down. The one good thing, it was water-based paint. So I just kept spraying it with water. My dad came down. We hooked up hoses, sprayed everything, and got a lot of it. But for the next several years, before I went off to college, I knew where there were little flecks of this stuff. My mother got home. Oh, it was an unbelievable story. It wasn't fair. It wasn't right. But I did it. And it happened, and life went on. 2 Corinthians chapter 11. 2 Corinthians chapter 11. Some of the greatest servants of God sometimes seem to suffer the most. That shouldn't be unusual. It seems like it is, but it shouldn't be unusual, because long-suffering is, in fact, a fruit of God's Spirit. Paul was under attack. Great apostles, brethren, have a habit of coming under attack, either during or after their lifetime. And Paul was no different. Verse 19, "For you suffer fools gladly," Paul wrote, "seeing you yourselves are wise." Now, a big stab there, kind of a little cynicism. "For you suffer." Now, suffer there doesn't really mean suffer. It means allow. "For you allow, if a man bring you into bondage, if a man devour you," because the context is false apostles, verse 13 to 15, "if a man take of you, if a man exalt himself, a man smite you on the face." You allow that. "You suffer fools gladly." People in the world have the term, "you suffer fools gladly." Well, they got it from Paul right here. It's a commonly used phrase, and it comes from the Bible right here. "I speak as concerning reproach, as though we had been weak. Howbeit, whereinsoever any is bold, I speak foolishly. I am bold also." There's nobody else out there is as bold as we are. They may come on and smack you and hurt you, but we're bolder than they are. Are they Hebrews? So am I. What do they have an advantage, these false apostles, over this true one? Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they the seed of Abraham? So am I. Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. Of course not. I am more. Now, what made Paul a great servant of God? Was it the fact that he could reach in his wallet, pull it out, and show his ordination certificate, and it says, apostle, or great servant of God? No. What was the proof of his apostleship? That he was a true minister of Christ, and these others were not. What was it? What technically, in his mind, credentialed him? Can we use that term? What was it? Well, here we go. Long list of credentials. See if they all fit a pattern. In labors more abundant, in stripes beyond or above measure, in prisons more frequent, in deaths oft. Now, if cats have nine lives, and Paul was still alive when he said this, and yet he said he'd been in deaths often. Well, he was in death-defying situations, and God always delivered him. So it's like he was put to death many times, but always survived. Like the time when the snake bit him on the island, deadly snake. He shook it off in the fire and went on like it was another day at the office. Of the Jews, five times received I 40 stripes, save one. They always did 39. 40 was the number of trial and test. Nobody wanted to go over that, so they stopped one short in case they counted badly. That's why they did it. Thrice was I beaten with rods. Eight times beaten alone. I've never been beaten. Never been beaten. Have you? Has anyone ever beaten you? Could you remain a servant of God if you were beaten 39 times with leather or a rod? Eight times, and we're just starting the list. Most people, brethren, do not understand. Suffering is part of life. Paul did understand it. Once was I stoned. I have never been stoned. A lot of people, oh, I was stoned, yeah, on drugs or booze. In their mind, that's all that means. Thrice I suffered shipwreck. I've often thought, it's enough to ride the Titanic. But to survive the Titanic, the Lusitania, and the Andrea Doria, I mean, that's what Paul was able to say. A night and a day I've been in the deep. I remember the movie that came out 20 years ago, 22 years ago, called The Deep, with the Robert Shaw and Nick Nolte and Jacqueline Bisset. I saw a few minutes of it the other day. It was terribly scary. And a new one coming out, I guess, about sharks called The Deep Blue Sea. I wonder how many dorsal fins went by as Paul was in the deep. I wonder how many times, what went through my legs? What was that? You know, 1,100 people went into the water, as the movie Jaws said, when the Indianapolis went down in World War II. And 350 of them survived. The rest the sharks took. A day and a night in the deep. In journeyings often, tired, in pain, in perils of waters. Now, wait a minute, we already read about shipwreck, but this must have been something else. Rushing rivers he had to forge, floods, in perils of robbers. Psychological pain. Am I going to be stolen? Am I going to be mugged? In perils of my own countrymen, in perils of the heathen, in perils in the city, perils in the wilderness, perils in the sea. This thing of water keeps coming up, doesn't it? Perils among false brethren. Let me tell you, when you deal with, you're exposed to false brethren, it hurts. There's pain. You suffer. We've all seen it. In weariness. Now, I already read that he was journeyings often and just tired in weariness. Look at this next one. And just plain painfulness. Did all those beatings catch up with him as he got older? Did God always miraculously heal him just like he did when the snake bit him? Was he left with, I got hit by those rocks? Later in his life, did he kind of roll his shoulder when he got out of bed and work the trick knee and so forth? Just painfulness. Was it pain of hunger? Because after it says in watchings often, watching, just watching, what's going on? Am I going to be arrested? Am I going to be attacked again? You know, if you're beaten eight times and stoned once, that's nine times. If that happened over 30 years, that basically is every 3 years, your number comes up again. And so he's watching. in hunger and thirst, and those are both their own kind of pain, by the way, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness, besides those things which are without that come upon me daily, the care of the churches. Who is weak and I'm not weak? Who's been through things, who can even begin to compare with the stories I've had to go through and left weak and recognizing my own physical nothingness? Who is offended and I burn not? You think I don't have a reason to be offended, Paul? You're offended? You don't think I burn inside with some of these things that have happened to me? I didn't deserve these things. I'm God's servant. I have to go on. He didn't say, it isn't fair. I think I'll just pout for a while. I didn't deserve that stoning. God, I'll see you in 2 weeks when I feel better and I'm ready to serve you again because you never told me about this. If I must needs glory, I will glory of the things which concern my infirmities. Paul said, I glory in what I went through because it strengthened me. The God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, which is blessed forevermore, knows that I lie not. When I say I glory in my infirmities, I'm telling you the truth, and God knows it. It's not some come-on. Why, in Damascus, the governor under Aretas, the king, kept the city of the Damascene, that's Damascus, with a garrison, desirous to apprehend me, and through a window in a basket was I let down by the wall and escaped his hands. You know, brethren, I've been in some tough situations before, but I've never been let down in a basket. I've never been let down in a basket because there was a sheriff and jailers outside ready to arrest me, and neither have you. As the Bible says, we have never striven unto blood against sin. Paul must have wondered at times, why me? Paul suffered physical pain, he suffered mental pain, he suffered emotional pain, he suffered psychological pain. There's nothing in the Scriptures that says it's any other way. But you know, brethren, people balk at a God who lets us feel pain and agony and suffering. They get mad at him. When I was in Manila, I toured the old Spanish fort called the Intramuros, and there were dungeons there. They were unbelievable, where people were put beside the Pasig River, below the walls of this guard tower, and you saw all the guard towers in this 15th century fort that reminded anyone who was there about how the Spanish had occupied the islands for hundreds of years. And they were right out in the sunlight. They could crawl back into this dank, awful cave that you often had water seep in, and it was awful. And people don't understand why God would allow that. Now God has taken his hands off of this earth, but he allows his servants to suffer too. And we can maybe say, well, I can understand why God allows the world to suffer. They're breaking his laws. They're not obeying him. But I don't know why he'd let his people suffer. We're trying to obey him. Does God enjoy looking down and seeing murders in Central Park in New York? Does he enjoy watching a baby just die of dehydration in a car because his mother was in, like one I read about a few days ago, playing bingo and forgot that her baby was out there, 3 months old, left him in a car, 108 degrees in the car, cooked the child? Does God look down and say, boy, that's it, they're suffering, I feel good, rubbing his hand? No, it makes God sick. But look at Hebrews chapter 5. Hebrews 5. Hebrews chapter 5. You know, the world looks, we won't turn there, but Luke 13 talks about these people who were killed by a whirlwind when this tower fell down on them. God asked, actually through Christ, who said, are these people particularly evil? He said, no, I tell you, no, but except you repent, you shall all likewise perish. And of course, these other people were killed while they were sacrificing, and their blood was mingled with the other sacrifices, again in Luke 13, 1-5, and you can read it later. Are they particularly sinners that this happened? No, time and chance happened to them. And clearly, they suffered. They were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Some people are just asleep in their bedroom, and a tornado hits, and they're killed and don't even know it. And in the resurrection, we'll have to tell them a tornado struck your house and you were killed instantly with all your wife and all your children. They may have been just good old folks. Hebrews 5. Here's the process, brethren. Hebrews 5 and verse 7. Christ is speaking of, who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears unto him, God, that was able to save him from death and was heard and that he feared, though he were a son, even though he was the Son of God, Jesus Christ, it says, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered. Christ learned to obey God, not that he ever disobeyed him, but he learned by suffering. And being made perfect, he became the author of eternal salvation unto all them that obey him. Do you see why it said in 1 Peter, we read earlier, he set us an example that we should walk in his path? If Christ, who never sinned, learned by the things that he suffered, brethren, are we going to be different? Suffering is inseparable from the Christian walk. You cannot separate it. Absolutely cannot. Look at Psalm 119. David understood this. David suffered a lot. In some ways, he could come up with a list similar to Paul. Psalm 119 and verse 67. Psalm 119, verse 67. Before I was afflicted, I went astray. But now have I kept your word. So verse 71, he says, therefore it is good for me, David can write, that I have been afflicted. Can you say that when you go through painful things, setbacks, reversals, injustices, things that don't seem fair, that I might learn your statutes? It's good that this happened. You look up the word affliction in the Hebrew, and it means abased, forced. It literally means browbeaten. David was browbeaten by Saul more than once. To look down upon, to depress. We might say he got put down. He was depressed, he was abased, he was browbeaten, and he said it was good because I learned from it. Why? Because people learn from suffering. 2 Timothy 2. You know what we just did, brethren? We just talked about another kind of pain that I have not mentioned directly before. I've mentioned physical, mental, emotional, and psychological pain. But you know, we have not talked about the most important kind of pain of all, and that's a thing called spiritual pain. Spiritual pain. It's a kind of suffering and pain that God felt when he had to flood the earth, and it said it grieved him. God can be grieved, brethren. It hurts him. I'm sure God felt other kinds of pain too, mental, psychological, but it hurt him that he had to wipe everybody out, start over with 8 people. And then it hurt so much that I'm never going to do that again. Not that he didn't know how he would feel until after he did it. He said, boy, I don't want to experience that again. I don't think that's the way it was, but he decided he would never do it again. That was real spiritual pain. 2 Timothy chapter 2. And verse 11, it is a faithful saying, for if we be dead with him, we shall also live with him. If we suffer, we shall also reign with him. This is a saying that was going around. It's a faithful saying. I don't know, maybe people were kind of quoting it back and forth, like we might have sayings or proverbs or quotes or poems. If we suffer, we shall also reign with him is a faithful saying. If we deny him, he also will deny us. If we believe not, yet he abides faithful. He cannot deny himself. That's a faithful saying. If you're willing to suffer. Now, if you're suffering, you got a bad attitude. You didn't learn anything. That's like a person giving, but not giving cheerfully. God loves a cheerful giver. Say, well, all right, here's my tithe. I obeyed God. And here's an offering on the holy day. Okay, and there it is. And you let it go. You see, God says, no, I want cheerful giving. Well, the giving doesn't mean anything. If you suffer, you say, I'm suffering, I'm unhappy, and I'm biting my lip and swallowing the blood. God doesn't want that. We have to take it, brethren. We have to handle it. All of God's servants have had to handle it. Turn to Genesis 32. God sometimes literally will put people in pain to see whether they will cry uncle. Because he has to know whether you and I are willing to develop this fruit of the Holy Spirit. Nobody can be over 3 or 5 or 10 cities as a member of the family of God who's unable to handle suffering for a long time. Because some of the children, physical children, who will be under us as members of the God family are going to hurt us. They're going to make decisions that are going to hurt us. Oh, it's going to hurt them, but it's going to hurt us. Do you as a parent not hurt when you see your children make decisions that hurt them? Or you say, hey, it just hurts my kids, it doesn't hurt me, I don't care, you know, no big deal. No, you hurt. Because when you see a child hurt, as a parent, you can't, oh, you want to incubate your children, but God says, no, as part of life, kids have to suffer. Some of them go all the way to the point where they take their lives by crazy things they do. Well, Genesis 32:24, and Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him. We now know this was God from the later in the verse. Until the breaking of the day. Now, I've done a little bit of wrestling. I was never very good at it. I was very bad at it. So I'm built wrong for it. But I wrestled a lot. All kids do. And, of course, wrestled with my kids. Wrestling's tiring. And when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh. God just dislocated his thigh. Now, if you've ever had a shoulder or a hip or a knee dislocated, the pain is nothing short of profound. It's unbelievable. And the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him, and he wouldn't let go. He had this persistence. And Christ wanted to see if he'd give up, if he'd be a quitter, if he would quit and say, it hurts, I quit. Some people do, a lot of people do. And he said, let me go, for the day breaks. Now, if God says, let go, wouldn't you probably let go? Jacob understood this was a test about whether or not he'd quit. Whether when the going gets tough, the tough get going. And he said, no, I will not let you go. Would you as a human being say, no, God, I won't? Now, God could have just burned him to a cinder if he wanted to. But he knew that this was about a blessing that was to come upon him, so he said, except you bless me. And his hip must have hurt, been inflamed, screaming with pain. He said, what is your name? He said, Jacob. And he said, your name shall now be called no more Jacob, but Israel, a prince of God instead of supplanter. For as a prince have you power with God and with men and have prevailed. He stayed the course. And then you read on down later that they named it Peniel, which means he had wrestled with God. He had seen God, the face of God. That's what it actually means, I believe. So why does God allow pain? In a nutshell. Ready? Here it is. I'm going to say it in a nutshell. Pain kicks the learning mechanism in the mind into gear. Good times don't. Pain kicks the learning mechanism in the mind into gear. That's why it says you learn by the things which you suffer. Now let me illustrate a couple of points. I want to read a couple of things to you. Then we're going to turn to a verse. Which do you enjoy more? I'm going to read you a joke. It's a good joke. Somebody sent it this week. Some brethren send me jokes. Two rednecks, Earl and Bubba, were driving down the road one day, each drinking a bud. Earl looks up and says, looky up there, Bubba. I see a real police roadblock. Them there policemen's going to catch us a-drinking for sure. No, sirree, they won't, says Bubba. Do exactly like I says, finish your beer, peel the label off of it, and put the bottle under the seat. Now stick the label on your forehead. Earl does exactly as Bubba says. They pull up the roadblock and stop with the beer label sticking to the middle of their foreheads. Naturally, the first thing the policeman asks is, you boys been drinking? No, sir, he says, Bubba, we on the patch. All right. Now, that's a funny joke, and I enjoy laughing, and I told you the joke to illustrate a point. I enjoy laughing. Laughing's not a bad thing. Laughing's a good thing. I've been getting some anonymous letters. I'd like to read an anonymous letter I got from somebody. The letter's a very fine letter. The person who has written it has said they're going to call me soon. Apparently they wrote me 10 letters. I never got any except the last two, and so I wrote the last one back, and I'm going to respond again to the next one that I got. But this was the one I responded to. Very respectful, very fine letter from a person with a group. And they're actually meeting with a group. And he says, just to show you the very respectful, fine attitude in the letter, I pray that you will continue to help all those who are truly trying to seek God and obey Him. And I know you have a tough job to do, and my prayers are with you and all who are truly trying to follow. But please don't think that it's supposed to be fun, because it's not. I had made a comment, an update, about how I hope Christianity can begin to be fun again. I was trying to stress the importance of happiness. But this person makes a very good point. He goes on and says, a soldier is at war is not supposed to have fun because he may lose his life, and that's not a joke. It's time to get real serious, especially now when so many we have known are in danger of losing eternal life because they were not serious with their calling. The tribulation of the day of the Lord will not be pretty pictures, nor will all the devastation that comes with us. Most, as you said, are very weak and have degenerated and need to prepare for what lies ahead before the times of refreshing come. Hope to keep in touch as much as God allows and so forth. And he signs it, a brother and friend in Christ. And I don't know who it is, but he says he knows me, and the last letter, he's going to call me soon. So I'm looking forward to that. In a way, he's right. In a way, he's absolutely right. This isn't as much fun in this age as maybe other ages and other times. We've been through too much pain, brethren. But pain kicks the learning mechanism into gear. Back to Ecclesiastes, a couple final verses. Ecclesiastes chapter 7. We read several verses, 7, 8, and 9. Let's go to 7 again. Ecclesiastes 7:14 is one of my favorite verses. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. When you're at a dance, have fun. When you're at a picnic like 3 weeks ago, have fun. When you're at a snow party or a Saturday night playing, you know, gin rummy or hearts or some card party, have fun. The day of prosperity, be joyful. When the good times are rolling, enjoy them. But in the day of adversity, consider. It doesn't say in the day of prosperity, consider, and in the day of adversity, be joyful, because life doesn't work that way. When you're suffering adversity, when you are suffering, and there is adversity, consider, because that's when we're supposed to learn. God also has set the one, these two different kinds of days in everyone's life, over against the other, to the end that man should find nothing after him. In other words, God gives you good times and bad times and good times and bad times and good times and bad times and good times and bad times to the end that you will stop and recognize eventually the cycle will end and I'm going to die. I'd better learn during the days of adversity. So I've always told people there's good news and bad news in that verse depending upon whether you are in a day of adversity or whether you're in a day of prosperity right now, because I guarantee you, every single one of you are in one or the other. There's nothing else left. If you're in a day of adversity, the good news is days of prosperity are coming because God says he puts the one over against the other. You can believe that in faith. The bad news is if you're in a day of prosperity, bad times are coming because God says he puts one over against the other in a cycle and you cannot escape it. It's absolutely a fact of life. You cannot get around it. To build character requires resistance. You can't build muscles unless you lift weights. You can't build them up. You have to have resistance, and suffering forms that. Look at Psalm 30 in verse 5. Psalm 30 in verse 5. Verse 4 says, sing to the Lord, O you saints of his, and give thanks at the remembrance of his holiness, for his anger endures but a moment. In his favor is life. Weeping may endure for a night. Weeping may endure for a night because God spanks you or he's angry with you, but joy comes in the morning. We had a saying around our house, today is a new day. We start over. And we followed that. You may weep tonight, brethren, for whatever reason, but the joy that will follow may be as soon as tomorrow morning. That's Ecclesiastes 7:14 at work, because sometimes the cycles of prosperity to adversity can be very swift. You can be prosperous and immediately in the middle of adversity because of a crash while you were talking to your wife and you hit a tree or somebody swerves, and just like that, you're in the middle of adversity and you're in a hospital bed for 6 months. Or you can be right back to prosperity because you go through adversity, you crash, but nobody's hurt, and you get out and you're very thankful. And you learn, and you move on, somebody hauls your car away. It just depends how it plays out. It just depends. Numbers 14:18, final verse. Numbers 14 and verse 18. Now Moses is praying to God. And now I beseech you, verse 17, let the power of my Lord be great, according as you have spoken, saying, this is what you say, God. You say that the Lord is long-suffering. God says that about himself in a variety of places. And of great mercy, forgiving iniquity and transgression, and by no means clearing the guilty, and visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation. And then he asks, please pardon these people for their great iniquity, and your mercy is greater, and so forth. The Lord is long-suffering. God grieves. You may think that what you're doing only hurts you. That's bad enough, because none of us likes pain. But you also hurt others. What you do hurts other people. You say, I just hurt myself and nobody else. Forget it. Other people are wounded by what you do. And absolutely, it grieves God when we hurt. We live in an age where people have been trained to believe that if you get wounded, you suffer injustice, you sue. Insurance companies are here to make it right. If somebody hurts you, you hurt them back. Suffering's wrong, so they need to suffer. You do unto them as they did unto you instead of the way you'd wish they did unto you. Everybody has their rights. Somebody sent me a list of the Bill of No Rights, because so many false rights have grown up in this country. I'll read it to you sometime. It's brilliant. But somebody actually submitted it, I believe, in the Minnesota legislature to consider establishing as law up there the Bill of No Rights, if I read it correctly. If you are suffering, thank God. Don't say, I don't have to suffer. If those verses won't convince you, brethren, then probably you're going to be a pretty tough case. You were called to suffer. Suffering kicks the learning mechanism in the mind and the gear. A lot of people don't understand that, but your God says so. It's clear. Two inescapable conclusions. Two absolutely inescapable conclusions. Pain is necessary. Number one. Pain is necessary. If you're suffering, thank God. Consider. You were called to it. And number two, suffering builds character and is a fruit of God's own character. Now maybe we're better equipped to look back at all of the lives of the very greatest servants of God and even look ahead at what the two witnesses will have to suffer, and we can better appreciate the suffering of Moses, the suffering of David, the suffering of Joseph in prison, the suffering of Peter, the suffering of most of the apostles who died violently, the suffering of Paul, sometimes the suffering of Mr. Armstrong, the suffering of Jesus Christ, the suffering of righteous Abel, the very first preacher of righteousness who was killed for what he did by his brother. Pain is absolutely necessary, number one, because suffering builds character and is a part of the character that is God, because God himself has demonstrated that he can suffer long.